It's being called the worst digital disaster to strike the internet in years. On Friday, a malicious computer program known as WannaCry struck more than 300,000 computers, including at hospitals in the United Kingdom. Users were told to pay about $300 in Bitcoin to regain access to their files. The software, known as ransomware, seems to have been stolen from the NSA, targeting a flaw in older versions of Windows. And it appears that the hackers may be tied to North Korea. How serious was this attack? And how vulnerable are our systems? Richard Clark, the former White House counterintelligence chief, is still with us, but let's add two more voices to the conversation here in studio. Laura Galante is the founder of Galante Strategies, a firm that helps corporations and governments respond to cyber threats. Laura, welcome to 1A.
Thanks.
And Michael Greenberger is the founder and director of the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. Michael, welcome.
Thank you.
We welcome your questions about cybersecurity on an institutional level, banks, hospitals, governments, and of course, everyday people like you and me. Some of our computers, perhaps this malicious piece of software may have passed through. Your questions about what happened, what's happening now, and how to protect yourself. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Laura Galante, how did this hack happen?
So on Friday is when the world started to hear about this and the victims that were getting hit now in over 150 countries. But where this really begins is in the disclosure in about the middle of April, where a group called Shadow Brokers disclosed vulnerabilities that the NSA had been keeping, you know, with the potential to use and target others. And it's from that April 15th group of documents that were put out on GitHub where the people who used this to create the ransomware found these vulnerabilities and then put them to use earlier in the week.
Now, there's been reporting lately that this could be tied to North Korea. How likely is that? And what might some of the motivations be?
So there are a couple reports out yesterday where a variety of researchers have compared the code, the malware that was used in WannaCry with malware that was used in the Sony attack back in 2013, and then also in Dark Soul, another attack widely seen as North Korean, and then the Bangladesh Bank investigation, which was a heist at a bank in Bangladesh that netted over $850 million. So code similarity gives some indications that these same attacks from the past that had North Korean fingerprints and forensics behind them are linked to WannaCry.
And maybe that Sony Pictures attack was, I wonder if you think that was a bit of an outlier. I mean, that was in response to that movie, The Interview, about a supposed plot to kill Kim Jong-un, and North Korea very verbally said, don't release this movie or we're coming after you. And sure enough, Sony Pictures Entertainment got hacked. But some of these other attacks, it sounds like, are just bank robberies.
It's a great point, Joshua. What distinguished Sony in a lot of ways was that this was perceived by North Korea to be an impingement on their information sphere, on the way that their leader was being perceived or mocked in the case of the movie. And what this really hits on is the heart of the need to think about motivation behind a lot of these attacks. And you know, you can't ascribe or attribute these attacks easily just based on the tools that are used or potentially the motivation behind them. It's kind of a multidiscipline approach that researchers and analysts take to think about why could someone be doing this? How are the tools indicative of who's behind it? And then what can we learn and take away, you know, as victims and also researchers thinking about it?
Michael Greenberger, this exploit seems to have come through a patch in or an error in Windows that had to be patched. Maybe this is kind of reveals to some people for the first time how easy it is for any little flaw in such a ubiquitous operating system to be used for disastrous consequences and how important it is to keep your Windows up to date.
Yes, exactly. Now, the operating system that appears to have been attacked is an outdated Windows operating system, Windows XP, which is effectively no longer serviced by Microsoft any longer. So there were not patches available. Now, once this problem was identified, Microsoft quickly put patches out, but it's a long way to get patches in, make them available, and have people who have these outdated operating systems use the patches. But the attack here, again, goes to the NSA was, as Microsoft itself has said, was stockpiling vulnerabilities in various operating systems with the idea that they would use it for offensive purposes to collect intelligence, et cetera. And Microsoft, the president of Microsoft famously came out yesterday and criticized intelligence agencies for inventorying these vulnerabilities because these vulnerabilities have been hacked themselves.
Yeah, and Richard Clark, I do want to get your take on that. But Michael, I'm also kind of wondering about the way that this wave of attacks stopped, what's been referred to as a kill switch. Can you explain what that kill switch was, how it worked?
Yeah, well, let me just say to begin with, that was a very lucky thing that happened, and I'm not sure it's going to happen in future attacks. But a young computer scientist in England, 22 years old, looked at the coding and saw within the coding that there was what is called a kill switch, which the code developers put in so they can stop this from getting out of hand. He discovered it. He was able to take action to get on the domain to trigger the kill switch himself. And it is claimed in the press that his activity not only dampened the effectiveness of the attack, but probably saved large portions of the United States from experiencing it.
We have to pause very shortly, but Richard Clark, I wonder what you make of the possibility that this exploit came from a tool that was stolen from the NSA and Microsoft's president's argument that the federal government shouldn't be keeping these kind of exploits. They should turn them over.
Well, on the point that the federal government, when it discovers a vulnerability in software, should turn them over right away to the manufacturer, I thought that was our government's policy. And certainly what we recommended to President Obama, I say we, I was a member of President Obama's intelligence review group, we recommended that. He said he agreed and accepted it. It appears that NSA did not follow policy. Because if they were following policy, they would have told Microsoft about this rather than trying to use it as an intelligence tool.
Well, we'll talk more about that on the other side. We got to take a quick pause, but we'll continue our conversation with former White House counterterror official Richard Clark, Laura Galante of Galante Strategies, and Michael Greenberger of the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. We'll get to more of your questions as well and talk about where we go from here in terms of keeping our infrastructure and your computer safe. Stay close. Before we get back to our conversation, we would love your help with tomorrow's program about what seems to be an ongoing string of crises here in Washington. It's hard to find a reporter in this town who feels perfectly at ease with everything that's been going on lately. Even some veteran journalists say they're struggling to keep up. Depending on who you ask, the Trump administration has whiffs of Watergate and the inevitability of a fall from grace on par with Richard Nixon's resignation back in 1974. If you lived through Watergate, does that sound right to you? Maybe you were just a kid watching your parents follow the coverage on the news. Perhaps you were working here in Washington when Watergate came to a head. Maybe you recall how people talked about that then compared to how we're talking about this now. Is the comparison spot on or overblown? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A, and press option 2. If you lived through the Watergate scandal, how similar or different does it feel to today's political climate? Tell us your story, 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212 and press option 2. You can also record yourself and email the audio file to 1A@WAMU.org. We will put that Watergate comparison to the test and share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Let's continue our conversation now about the ransomware attack with Richard Clark, former White House counterterror official, Laura Galante of Galante Strategies, and Michael Greenberger of the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. So Microsoft is telling us to patch Windows, to update Windows. If you're using an old, outdated version of Windows XP, where have you been? Put your Flywheel iPod down and buy a new version of Windows, but patch Windows. Boop. That's it. Is that all we have to do, Laura? Is there nothing more to it? We just have to keep Windows up to date?
Well, in the case of what we're looking at now, if we just want to think about WannaCry, that is what needs to be done if you have a Windows XP, if you have one of these later versions of Windows, the patches have been issued. So yes, in simplest form. But thinking more broadly about cybersecurity and the approach that we need here, this attack, this incident over the last 4 or 5 days here, should really be a wake-up call, not just for basic kind of cyber hygiene practices like patching, but for a multi-layered approach for how different companies, how different networks, how individuals are thinking about cybersecurity. Whether it's going back a year to the DNC hack and thinking about, you know, the different information attacks and the way that information's leaked and what you put in your emails. If you wouldn't say it out loud, why would you write it in an email?
Right.
You know, all the way to thinking about basic patching and network segmentation. So we need to think about all these different aspects and really get people understanding what are the digital equivalents to locks on your doors.
Chris emailed us, where we live in Indiana, there is no high-speed internet available. To download an update takes days, two or more at times, and completely uses all available bandwidth so no work can be done on other computers in the house. And then if an error occurs, we have to start the process all over again and take even more time. Is it any wonder why people don't install updates and patches? I guess that just speaks to kind of how very disparate broadband access is in parts of this country, even though I think most of the country has access to some form of high-speed internet. Laura, you'd probably know better than me.
Yeah, I mean, I think the wider access to the internet is globally, the more we're going to see issues where you have kind of a staggered approach to how large a malware can or an incident can really travel, right? With China, for instance, there were a lot of initial infections, and there's not a patch available if you had bootlegged copies of Windows, right? And that was part of the problem with a lot of the victims in China. So we're really looking at kind of a discordant way that different people are keeping their systems up to date, and people really need to think about what are the basics that they need to follow every day.
Richard Clark, could you talk a little bit about that? I know that one of the major challenges, for example, as China became a more open economy, was intellectual property rights, including bootlegging of software. And that has a lot of implications, of course, for business. But as we're learning now, it also has implications for homeland security, for stopping cyber attacks. How seriously do you see the world's governments taking that these days?
Well, I think we've got two problems here. One problem is largely outside of the United States, in places like Russia and China, where people have bootlegged versions of Windows, so they're very old. And frankly, because they got them in a criminal way, Microsoft has no responsibility to protect them, although Microsoft has done that in this instance. The other problem, though, is here in the United States, where there is what I call cyber malpractice going on. Any company that didn't patch, any company, organization, that didn't patch its system after having been warned for 2 months to do so, and with Microsoft saying that this was a critical security patch, companies that didn't do that and got infected engaged in cyber malpractice. It's just that simple. Now, I know it's blaming the victim, but sometimes the victim in this case deserves some blame.
We got lots of great comments from our listeners, including about the larger implications of this. Martina emailed, WannaCry was about infrastructure disruption, not ransom. Chances are it was a probe to see how much damage could be done. Michael Greenberger, what do you think of that?
Well, it was a ransom. They did ask for Bitcoin payments to decrypt the encryption that was created. I think a total $70,000 was collected. But the problem here is, as has been suggested, whatever patch Microsoft made available for this event, there are other events that are coming down the road. What we saw this weekend is going to be repeated. There are other vulnerabilities that are NSA had stockpiled that are already beginning to be used. There will be no kill switches. And a lot of this, actually, the ability to defend has there are assets available that really aren't being deployed to their fullest extent. There's something called the National Institute for Standards and Technology that has so-called a cyber framework that is an A to Z ability to upgrade systems so that you aren't attacked. That right now is sort of, it's out there as a best practice. Some people use it, some people don't use it. Many states are requiring state governments to use it. But there's been a major fight in Congress between those who just want to create incentives to protect, to do the patches, to do the best practices, and those who want to mandate it. And this is almost like having a drug on the market that is deadly. The Food and Drug Administration would take it off the market. We need to have oversight here where sources, codes, whatever are being used need to be taken off the market. Directives need to be issued. Why? Because lives are at stake.
Laura, I realize we forgot to define something for people who may not be up on the internet currency world. What is Bitcoin?
So Bitcoin is kind of the lifeblood behind ransomware conceptually, because what Bitcoin does is it's a currency that's virtual, so it's only used on the internet, and it allows you to basically make an anonymous payment. So you don't need to know who's on the other end of the payment. And what that did is it allowed for, you know, this broader scale of types of attacks using ransomware, malware that holds your system hostage, encrypts it, and you have to pay Bitcoin back. So the people on the other side of this are basically very difficult to follow, and this approach to how do we follow the money to get to who's behind this has really been made that much more difficult by Bitcoin.
Andrea tweeted us, does it help using a VPN with encryption to prevent attacks from ransomware like WannaCry, a VPN, a virtual private network? How does that work, and might that protect you from ransomware?
It depends how your network's set up. So, you know, what sort of firewalls do you have? What sandboxing capabilities? I mean, these are the types of questions that, you know, are worth asking the IT professionals and IT security professionals behind their network setup. And to Michael's point, how is the government either going to regulate, incentivize, or start creating some guidelines that are widely seen as kind of the go-to for different companies, and then they can be held accountable to this? And right now we're looking at how are the courts going to litigate some of the shareholder cases after a cyber attack. And, you know, we're doing this in almost a kind of backward way while we have this much at stake in terms of our security.
So I want to make sure I fully understand your answer to Andrew's question. It sounds like you're saying that a VPN, a virtual private network, might help. But as I understand it, ransomware often gets in your computer because you let it. Something pops up or an errant window opens, or you get some screwy email that comes from wellsfargo.co and not wellsfargo.com. And it says, your password is missing. Click this link. You must do it now. You're going to lose all your money. You click the link and then you have let the raiders in. They didn't storm the gate. You open the door.
You're right. And in some cases, you know, you don't even need to use malware if you can get someone to give their valid credentials into the network, and then you're into the network. So with WannaCry, that wasn't the case. That's what made WannaCry very scary, right? You didn't have to click on an email. You didn't have to do something that was suspicious. It was because you had an unpatched vulnerability a zero day.
Michael? Yep.
Yeah, and the other thing that's got to be remembered, and we're seeing in real-world practices, not everybody protecting their network is a Fortune 500 company. You've got a lot of small businesses out there who just do not have the resources, even if they're told this is what you must do to make your network protected. They are so far outside the capability of doing it that they're just not going to do it. And as you say, when it comes down to the individual, I am sure that many Windows XP systems will not be patched after this. There needs to be more direction from the government about this, just as safety precautions for medications or devices or other things. These malpractices are a matter of life and death. People could be on operating tables and couldn't finish the operation because the computer system is encrypted.
There were actually a number of cases where hospitals on Britain's national health system had to turn people away from emergency rooms because of these issues with the computers. Mike tweeted, the NSA continues to be a rogue agency with no oversight. NSA caused this problem, not the companies who didn't patch. Don't deflect. Richard Clark, what do you think?
Well, I think there's a lot of blame to go around. First of all, the attacker, whoever that was, perhaps North Korea, perhaps. Secondly, I do blame the companies that didn't patch. And thirdly, I very much blame NSA for two reasons. One, for, as we've already discussed, when they found out about the vulnerability, not telling Microsoft, but rather using it to spy. And secondly, for their poor security. This is the third time in 4 years there's been a major breach of their security. And something has to be done. The management at NSA is not working. And either we have to change out the leadership of NSA, or we have to bring in some outside control from perhaps the Director of National Intelligence.
A few more questions about ransomware and how it affects people directly. Eckbert emailed, if you're the victim of ransomware, can the virus reach beyond the computer on which it's loaded? If your data is stored on an external drive, like a memory stick or a USB attached drive, can it reach that? Michael?
The answer is yes. And in fact, this ransomware was moving from Windows XP system to Windows XP system. So if there's a vulnerability at one point in the system, the vulnerability can spread throughout the system. And that's why if you have a lot of small businesses out there who don't know enough or don't have the capability of even following instructions, if their systems get infected, that can infect the Fortune 500 companies who are trying their very best to set up defenses to these kinds of attacks.
A number of our listeners are also talking about having to deal with older versions of software. John tweeted, some people are stuck with older systems to run old machinery. I was stuck on Windows 3, well into the Windows 98 years for an instrument. I forgot all about Windows 3. John tweeted, there are legitimate reasons to retain Windows XP, ranging from still needed legacy software to sustainability. Do we always have to buy the latest iGadget? And Randy also wrote whether this affected anyone running an Apple device. I do take the point about sometimes just needing an older version of Windows because a newer one would be incompatible with machinery. What do we do in those cases, Laura?
I think Microsoft took that point in this case, and that's why they were willing to go issue patches for versions that they weren't still supporting. To the point of the, you know, were you protected if you were on a Mac? In this case, you were. You didn't have to patch if you weren't running a Windows system that was there. So, you know, the question of do you have to buy the latest version and, you know, how much should you demand as a consumer from technology companies to keep up former versions is a worthwhile debate. And again, something that the purchaser at the small business, at the manufacturing plant, at the Fortune 500 needs to consider as they take into account what their tech purchases are.
And Apple tends to be very aggressive about pushing users to the latest version of Mac OS or iOS. You kind of have to keep up with Apple if you want to keep using their devices. Richard Clark, before we run out of time, I wonder what you make of the nature of this threat and the people who might be behind it. I believe Michael Greenberger said that the total amount of money involved in this ransom was like $70,000. It kind of reminds me of Dr. Evil saying he's going to hold the world ransom for $1 million. I mean, it's not that much money. Does that show a lack of sophistication? Is it possible that the people who did this just got lucky?
It's possible. It's also possible that the people who did this did it not to make money at all. But to show off some of the points that we've just been discussing. It's also possible it's North Korea, because North Korea has a very well-established track record of making money through cyber attacks, through selling counterfeit U.S. $100 bills, and even selling heroin. So that's the kind of government we're dealing with in North Korea. I'm not there yet to say that this was North Korea. I think we need more research on that. My suspicion is that this was not about money.
Laura, you get the last word.
A few researchers have pointed out how sloppy the back end of this attack really was. The ability to actually get payments, how high profile it became, and how it kind of went out of control and how widely it spread. These were the indications that someone behind this might be doing this purely to wreak havoc more than just the monetary gains. And it really will take time and research and information sharing before we understand the full breadth of what happened over the weekend.
That's Laura Galante, the founder of the cybersecurity firm Galante Strategies. Laura, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks.
Michael Greenberger, the director of the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
And former White House counterintelligence chief Richard Clark. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Remember to send us your stories about whether the comparisons to Watergate sound right to you. 855-236-1A1A or email 1A@WAMU.org. 1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. And update your Windows. I mean, XP? Really? This is 1A.